Well, turn with me again, please, to Luke's Gospel and chapter 8, and we shall be looking at verses 22 to 39. Now, we began last week's sermon looking at the first three verses of chapter 8, and I used in that context the illustration of reading a newspaper and the way in which there are generally a few pages, aren't there, somewhere in between the editorials in the middle and the sports pages at the end, a few pages that you just skip over. They're full of business news and share prices, or they're full of adverts, something like that, and so you pretty much just skip over them. And I said then that you might think at first sight that these first three verses of Luke chapter 8 are a little bit like that. They have a rather bland and unremarkable feel to them. They don't immediately leap out of the page and grab you as a reader. Perhaps it's best just to bypass them altogether. Well, I hope that I demonstrated to you last week that in actual fact those three verses do have their own importance and their own usefulness. But be that as it may, we don't have the same problem when we come to this morning's passage. There's certainly nothing bland or unremarkable about these 18 verses. In actual fact, they're packed full of drama and action and excitement. And so this morning I would like us to spend a few moments together enjoying this passage. These are narratives which for many of us have been firing our imaginations as long as we can remember. And I'd like us too, of course, to have our hearts and minds instructed by them. I'd like us to look at the passage under four headings. First of all, this morning, journey. Journey. Because we read in verse 22, one day Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side of the lake." So they got into a boat and set out. And of course, no sooner have they set out on this voyage than Jesus falls asleep. And it always seems to me that that detail is not only a remarkable testimony to the authenticity of Jesus' humanity. Here he is, and he's clearly subject to the same weakness and the same fragility as we are in our humanity. He too sometimes just needs a good sleep. But it also seems to me a remarkable testimony to the authenticity of this narrative. You see, people will look at this passage and they'll say, well, of course, Jesus didn't really still the storm with a word. That's ridiculous. Clearly, what we have here is the gospel writers just making up a story to present Jesus as this great and amazing and supernatural figure. And when you first hear it, that kind of thing can sound formidably plausible. Until you stop and think, hang on a minute. If the gospel writers were just making up this story in order to suit their own purposes, why did they include this detail about Jesus falling asleep? Because that doesn't suit their purposes. It doesn't add anything to the picture of Jesus as a great, amazing, supernatural figure. On the contrary, in fact, it only appears to undermine and jeopardize that particular picture of him. And so, as I say, it seems to me a wonderful, remarkable testimony to the authenticity of this narrative, this detail of Jesus falling asleep. But while he's asleep then, the boat gets caught up in a fierce storm. And during the middle of this storm then, the disciples, they flee to Jesus. They're at their wits' end. They're helpless. They flee to Jesus. They say to him, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." And then, of course, we have this extraordinary moment when Jesus wakes up and gets up and rebukes the wind and the waves. But it seems to me that Luke here really wants to draw our attention to the two questions that are asked in verse 25. First question is on the lips of Jesus himself. "Where is your faith?" he asks. "Where is your faith?" Now, at first sight, that may seem a rather unreasonable question. All the disciples have done All they have said in verse 24 is, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." Well, surely that was a perfectly reasonable prognosis in the circumstances. At the end of the day, that's what happens. When a fierce storm is convulsing the Sea of Galilee and you're out there in the middle of it in a tiny fishing boat being swamped by gigantic waves, this is what happens. You drown. And it doesn't make any difference that you might be a disciple of Jesus. You might be a follower of him, a believer in him. You're still not immune to that sort of thing. You still drown. And so, why should these disciples have thought any differently? How could they have known that on this particular occasion Jesus was actually going to stand up and rebuke the wind and the waves? How were their words in verse 24 an indication that their faith had gone AWOL? Well, I think the answer is probably this. The disciples should have understood that that boat they were on couldn't go under. It couldn't sink. It couldn't get broken up by the waves. Not because they, the disciples, were on it. As we've already said, disciples of Jesus drowned too. But because Jesus was on it. You see, when Jesus asks them, "Where is your faith?" he's effectively saying to them, "Look, where is your faith in me as Messiah? As the Messiah who has come to save his people. And who, until he has saved his people, and until he has accomplished that mission, is absolutely invulnerable to every danger and every threat. And every snare, whether it be that of the Pharisees who are conspiring to wipe him out, or whether it be that of demons, or whether it be that of the raging Galilean elements themselves." That's why Jesus' question here is, I think, a reasonable one at the end of the day. He's saying to them, where is your faith? Not where is your faith in a God who always saves his drowning people, but where is your faith in me as the Messiah who is on an absolutely invincible mission that nothing whatsoever is ever going to derail. But having vindicated this question then from being unreasonable, it seems to me that we can actually go further than that and say that it was actually a profoundly encouraging question. You see, imagine I had turned up at church this morning on foot and someone had met me at the door and said, "Oh, hello, where's your helicopter?" That question wouldn't make sense because I don't possess a helicopter. If, on the other hand, I turned up in that way this morning and one of you had said to me, "Hello, where's your car?" That question would make sense because I possess a car. And similarly here, when Jesus asks his disciples, "Where is your faith?" that question only makes sense if indeed the disciples possess faith. Jesus, in other words, is implicitly acknowledging here that that is the case. He's implicitly saying to them, "Look, you do believe in me. You do believe I'm the Messiah. You do believe I'm on the kind of mission that nothing in heaven or on earth or under the earth is ever going to frustrate or abort or curtail or derail in any way. You do believe that. You're believers. You're in the category of that fourth soil that I was talking about before in my parable that receives and responds to the word of God properly. There is true and genuine faith somewhere in those hearts of yours. It's just not showing itself. It's just not being acted upon. It's just not regulating your emotions. It's just not controlling your responses. It's just not dictating your behavior right now at this very minute on this storm-battered fishing boat. It's been temporarily driven out of sight by the circumstances of the hour. It's been momentarily buried, if you like, beneath an avalanche of fear and panic and anxiety." That's what Jesus is saying here implicitly. And as I say, I find something profoundly encouraging in that. Because there are times in our lives when our faith disappears virtually altogether. Aren't there? There are times in our lives when our faith almost goes out of sight completely, when it becomes eclipsed almost altogether by the situations we get ourselves in, the choices we make, the sins we get tangled up with. And at those times, other Christians can be very quick to give up on us and to write us off. You have no faith. And we ourselves can be very quick to give up on ourselves and write ourselves off. I have no faith. But if there's one person who isn't quick to give up on us and who isn't quick to write us off, it's Jesus Christ, who says not, you have no faith, but where is your faith? I know it's there somewhere. Where is it? Where's your faith gone? And perhaps this morning, you're in a mess spiritually. Perhaps you can look back on an exciting conversion experience many years ago, a Christian baptism perhaps, and then many years of active Christian discipleship. But it all seems to have come to nothing now. It's all gone. It's all died down. It's all faded away. And you've resigned yourself to that. And perhaps Jesus Christ is saying to you this morning, look, stop writing your own spiritual obituary and answer instead this question. Where is your faith? I know it's there somewhere. It's there. It's there no less than it was there in the hearts of my panicking disciples on the Sea of Galilee. Find it. You may have to poke around amidst the embers of your heart to find that tiny little spark of faith, but it's there somewhere. And this morning you have the opportunity to uncover it and to once more fan it into a large, glowing flame. Where is your faith? That's the first question. But the second question, who is this? On the lips of the disciples, who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. And what's striking about this question is that it's with this question that Luke closes this little narrative section. He doesn't close this section about the stilling of the storm with a verdict, with an opinion, with a statement. He closes it with an unanswered question. Who is this? And it seems to me that in doing that, Luke is clearly wanting his readers to answer the question for themselves. He's not giving us the opinion of others so that we can say, oh, that's what they thought of Jesus. He's asking the question to us and he's leaving it unanswered so that we have to give an answer to it. And in doing that, Luke is really distinguishing himself quite markedly, isn't he, from ordinary biographers. Ordinary biographies set out to entertain us, to stimulate us, to inform us. But they rarely set out to challenge us to make a decision. And yet that's what Luke is doing here. As he writes the story of Jesus, here at this point, he is challenging his readers to make a decision. Well, why is he doing that? Why is he distinguishing himself like that from ordinary biographies? Well, I think the answer is this. When I read a biography of Martin Luther, for instance, it'll tell me about him nailing those 95 theses to the door. And it's all very interesting. But it doesn't have any direct relevance for me today. When I read a biography of Winston Churchill, it'll tell me about his decision that Britain should go to war. And again, it's all very interesting. But it doesn't have any direct relevance for me today. When I read a biography of David Beckham, it'll tell me all about his bust-up with Alec Ferguson that precipitated his departure from Manchester United. And that's mildly interesting, at least. But it doesn't have any direct relevance for me today. But when I read Luke and he tells me about Jesus Christ stilling the wind and the waves with a word, issuing a command to the creation and the creation obeying him, that has direct relevance for me today. I can't just read that and say, well, that's fascinating, then close. close the book and say, I'll pick it up again tomorrow. Because only God can issue commands to the creation, and the creation obeys him. That's his prerogative. And if Jesus did it, then Jesus must be God. And if Jesus is God, then he owns the right, he has the right to my worship and to my obedience and to my submission and to all the days and the hours and the minutes of my life from this point onward. And so I'm saying that's why Luke, unlike other biographers, challenges his readers to make a decision. He forces his readers to stop being mere spectators here in this story and to make a decision. And perhaps this morning you've come to this church to be a spectator because you quite like hearing the stories of Jesus. They entertain you a bit, they stimulate you, and that's why you've come. Well, don't you realize this morning the ridiculousness of that? You can't be merely stimulated by a man who bossed the elements around. You have to be brought to your knees before such a man, exclaiming from the bottom of your heart, as that man Thomas once did, my Lord and my God. That's the first thing we notice here, journey. Secondly this morning, destination. Destination. Now we perhaps have a tendency to rather neglect and ignore the geography of the Gospels, so that when, for instance, Jesus performs a miracle, we tend to remember the various details of the miracle, but we don't remember where it took place. It could have been Jerusalem, it could have been Capernaum, it could have been Nain. It doesn't really make much difference to us. But I think that there are times when it's important, the geography. And I think this is one such occasion when the geography is important. Jesus isn't crossing the Sea of Galilee here to just another random location. He's crossing the Sea of Galilee here to a highly significant location. For one thing, it's a Gentile location. Even if you don't know that from your map of the area, even if you don't know from your mental map that the region of the Gerasenes is the very Gentile area on the eastern shore of the Lake of Galilee, you should at least have guessed it from the presence of the herd of pigs, shouldn't you? The pigs that are mentioned in verse 32. You wouldn't have got a herd of pigs in Jewish territory, because to Jews, of course, the pigs were unclean animals. Having been brought up in the Vale of York, I'm fairly accustomed to the sight of large fields full of innumerable pigs. But for Peter and James and John, it must have been a very strange, even unnerving sight. As their boat pulled up to that shoreline, seeing the hillside covered with pigs. This was the kind of territory for prodigal sons, not the kind of territory for respectable Jews like them. So it was a Gentile location. But beyond that, and indeed doubtless because of that, there was something more sinister about this place. Not only was it a Gentile location, but in some way, it seems to have been a demonic location. It seems to have been a hotbed, a heartland of evil, devilish activity, a veritable hive of demonic, hellish powers. Look at the evidence. For one thing, there's the storm that we've already considered, which Jesus had to contend with in order to get this, to this place, which to me gives the impression that there were powerful supernatural forces who didn't want Jesus and his disciples to get to that place, who didn't want to be disturbed by him. Or then there's the language of verse 27. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. And the way Luke writes that, it almost gives the impression that Jesus still had one foot in the boat and only one foot on the shore when he was first encountered by this demonic activity. He didn't have to kind of scratch around the surface and go off the beaten track. in this region of the Gerasenes to find demons. Clearly this was the primary feature, the leading characteristic of this place. As soon as you stepped ashore, you came face to face with this phenomenon of demonic activity in the region of the Gerasenes. Or then there's the detail in verse 30. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. Now, I'm no expert in such matters, but presumably it only takes one demon to possess someone. Earlier on in this very chapter, it's considered worthy of note that Mary Magdalene had been possessed by 7 demons. That was quite something, 7 demons. But here, this man, it's a legion. Many demons, Luke says. Clearly, demon possession is on a different scale altogether in the region of the Gerasenes. And then just one further detail, which I suppose follows on from that probably, just to notice the extremities to which demon possession drives people in the region of the Gerasenes. Verse 29, many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains. And this is the thing that interests me. And had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Back in chapter 4, Jesus had healed a demon-possessed man. But that man was still, to a large extent, it seems, integrated within society. Where was he? He was in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. And his presence in the synagogue didn't cause all kinds of chaos. They hadn't cancelled the service because he turned up. They hadn't proclaimed a state of emergency because he was there. It was clearly part of normal life. Oh yes, here comes the demon-possessed man in our midst again. But not in the region of the Gerasenes. Their demon possession was of such a fierce nature that such people were unfit for normal society. And so I hope you're building up a picture here. I hope you're getting a sense here of the kind of place that Luke is trying to portray to us. As one of the commentators puts it very succinctly, this is a place where no one would want to go for any reason. And yet here's Jesus, and he's going there. And it seems to me that what we're encountering here is a critical moment in the gospel narrative. All right, Jesus has done some amazing things, including some amazing exorcisms on his home turf. There within the relatively safe and respectable confines of Jewish society and Jewish territory. He shone all right there in his comfort zone. But how is he going to fare now he's stepping out of his comfort zone? How is he going to fare now he's stepping onto Gentile soil where demons apparently rage with unparalleled ferocity? Is he going to be able to make any impression there? How is he going to fare? And I suppose that contained within that general question are two more specific questions. First of all, is Jesus really that great? Is he really the one about whom we sang earlier, whose name is high over all, and at whose name devils, not just the emasculated, toned-down kind of devils you get in Jewish territory, devils fear and fly? And second question, is there any hope for the Gentile world? Is there any hope for the Gentile world? Or are all the blessings of Jesus going to be contained within Jewish territory, in Jewish society? Is there any hope beyond the Jews? Well, those questions then take us on to our third heading, outcome. Outcome. And in a word, Jesus fares extremely well. As he steps out of his comfort zone, as he treads onto this Gentile soil, he fares extremely well. And I suppose the supreme proof of that is the transformation in the life of this man. But I think there are a couple of other indications here of Jesus faring extremely well here in the devil's own backyard, as you might almost call it. For one thing, there's the demonic identification of Jesus in verse 28, where they shout out, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Son of the Most High God." And what's interesting about that is that back in chapter 1, verse 32, the angel Gabriel had said to Mary, before Jesus was born, he'd said to Mary that the child you will have will be called Son of the Most High. And yet, seemingly up until this point, that hasn't happened yet. Up until this point, no one actually has called Jesus the Son of the Most High. But you see, it's almost as if as Jesus steps now onto this Gentile, demon-infested territory, he rises to the occasion. He rises to the challenge. And he suddenly, in his bearing and in his demeanor, becomes more matchless, godlike, and divine than ever. And for the first time then, forces the acknowledgement, this is the Son of the Most High God. But then the other indication that he's faring so well here in this Gentile, demon-infested environment is the sheer terror that you see in these demons. The sheer terror, it's there in verse 28, isn't it? "I beg you, don't torture me." And it's there again in verse 31, "And they begged him repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss." In other words, they recognize in this visitor not merely the authority to drive them out of the man that they're possessing, but the authority to drive them to their eternal fate. And by the way, it's interesting, isn't it, that the demons are scared about their eternal destiny. We know from Matthew 25 that those whom Jesus calls the goats, those who aren't believers in him, those who aren't Christians, that they will share the same eternal destiny as the devil and his angels. And if the devil and his angels, therefore, are scared stiff of that eternal destiny, so should you be if you're not a Christian this morning, if you're not a believer in Jesus Christ. So I'm saying then, that this is the outcome. As Jesus arrives at this grim, unpromising destination, a Gentile place, a demonic place, a remarkably hideous and ugly location to go to. As Jesus arrives there, what's the outcome? Well, he shines. He shines here just as much, if not more so, than he had done back in Jewish territory. And as we see, devils once again fearing and flying. And to answer then our two questions. First of all, is Jesus really that great? Yes, he is really that great. He really is Lord. Even here in the region of the Gerasenes, he is Lord. Even here, there's not a single demon that can challenge or rival his authority. Even here, he is utterly supreme in his lordship and in his control. Do you realize that this morning? Do you realize the sheer greatness of Jesus Christ? Do you realize that he is Lord in an absolute and unqualified sense? Who's in control? Not George W. Bush. Not Osama bin Laden. Jesus Christ. And that's not only in the sphere of the nations of this earth and the politics of this earth. That's even in the sphere of the supernatural, heavenly realms, the realm of demons and angels. He is Lord. If you want to be really safe, you need to come and side with him. If you want to be on the side of the King of Kings, you need to come and bow the knee to Jesus Christ. You need to subscribe and you need to sign up to his army, his forces, his people. He is truly Lord. But then the other question, is there hope for the Gentile world? Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And here, I think, in this passage, we have really a remarkable little indication that ultimately, although, yes, Jesus' work throughout most of his ministry was confined to Jewish circles, ultimately, he wasn't going to rest simply with driving all the demons out of Galilee and Judea. Ultimately, as the following years and decades and centuries would ensue, Jesus Christ was also going to drive the demons out of Samaria and Europe and the Americas and Asia and Africa, so that he would indeed be what the Apostle John twice calls him, the Savior of the world, the one who drives Satan and his forces out of every corner of this planet and establishes his church and his kingdom in its place. We've seen the journey, we've seen the destination, we've seen the outcome. Finally and briefly, response. Because in this passage we're shown two responses, aren't we, to all this, to all that Jesus has done here. First of all, the response of the local people. Because we're told, aren't we, that they are informed of what has happened to this demon-possessed man, and they're interested by this, they rush to the scene. And we're told in verse 37, then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. And I think that Luke is doing something quite important here. You see, earlier in this passage, he has exposed us, hasn't he, to demon possession at its very worst, at its very ugliest. And what would you say was one of the primary characteristics of demon possession as Luke has just shown us it? Was it not sheer irrationality? Sheer irrationality. It's irrational to live out your days naked in a graveyard. And yet that's what this man was doing. Demon possession had made him utterly lawless, utterly anarchic. It had made him a man of utter irrationality. And now Luke is showing us the local people of the region of the Gerasenes. And I think he's saying to us, look, these people are irrational too. Here they are, and they come along and they see this scene of the formerly demon-possessed man now in his right mind with clothes on, sitting at the feet of Jesus. You'd have thought they'd have been dancing in the streets. But instead, probably because of the pigs, probably because they'd just gone and lost a whole load of livestock, instead, they don't like it. And they ask Jesus to leave. In other words, they were more concerned about a herd of pigs than about the restoration of a broken man. And I think in that Luke is saying to us, look, these people, they may look outwardly a lot more decent and respectable than the demon-possessed man did. But ultimately they too are in the grip of demons as well. It's having a different manifestation. But there's this in common. They too have been driven to irrationality. They're not seeing things straight. They see this beautiful sight of a restored man and they don't want anything to do with it. The same demons are gripping them as well, and the same irrationality is in their brains too. And I'm sure I don't need to spell out to you the relevance of that for today. You see, the trouble is that we often read a passage like this and we get just hung up on this whole issue of demon possession. Well, is there still demon possession? Is that what you hear about in Africa and all this kind of thing? And I don't know. I don't know whether there's still this kind of demon possession. There may well be, there may not be. I don't know. But I know that there's still many people around who are in the same position as the local people of the region of the Gerasenes that Luke shows us at the end of this passage. Many people who, if it's not pigs, are put in something before the restoration of their broken lives at the feet of Jesus Christ, who are counting something, whether it's their possessions, whether it's their house, whether it's their career, whether it's their family, something as more valuable than the restoration of their souls at the feet of Jesus. And I think that Luke would say to us in 2007, as he saw our society, yep, just like the people of the region of the Gerasenes, they're in the grip of demons. It's having a very respectable manifestation, perhaps, but it's still the grip of demons. But the second response is the man himself who has been restored. And we read, don't we, that he begged to be able to go with Jesus. But Jesus didn't let him. And instead, he sent him away, saying, return home and tell how much God has done for you. It's a reminder, isn't it, that sometimes the spheres in which we want to serve Jesus are not the spheres in which Jesus wants us to serve him. This man had set his heart on being one of the inner disciples, if you like, being with Peter and James and John and the others, traveling around in the footsteps of Jesus. He'd set his heart on that. He thought that was the role for him. Jesus said, no, that's not the role for you. I've got another role for you, which might not be as glamorous, but it's just as important. I want you to go back to this godless place, this godless town, this demon-gripped town, and I want you to tell the good news of the gospel there. And God doesn't call us all to the mission field. He doesn't call us all to the ministry. He doesn't call us all to be full-time Christian workers. But every role that he gives to his people is equally valid and equally important and equally significant in the kingdom of heaven. Perhaps yours is to go back to your town, go back to your family, go back to your workplace and tell what God has done for you. But the other thing just to notice about this man as we close is that Jesus restored him to the community, didn't he? We read in verse 27, when Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. And immediately you're thinking, well, if he's from the town, what's he doing here? But then we read in verse 39, Jesus telling him to return home. And then at the end of the verse, the man goes back to the town. And I don't want to make too much of that, but we're very aware, aren't we, in our society today of those who are dislocated from society. The uncontrollable youths, the hoodies as they're often called. Those who perhaps through drugs and drink and just antisocial behaviour generally are, as I say, dislocated from the community, dislocated from society. And, of course, politicians are always trying to address that, whether it's through ASBOs or through introducing more youth groups and more community events and things like that. And these are good things in and of themselves, perhaps, and we shouldn't, of course, despise such political measures. These are tokens of God's common grace. But I think this is a reminder that ultimately it's only Jesus Christ who can really take someone who has been dislocated from the community and make them part of the community again. And yes, it's good to get involved in any channels that we can to restore dislocated people back to the community. But these things will always have their limitations. It's only when Jesus Christ takes a person and transforms that person's life and gives them a new direction in serving and following and glorifying him, it's only then that person can really throw themselves back into the heart of the community. Which is why, of course, we don't just engage in social community work. We don't just support our politicians. We preach the gospel and we seek any way we can to get to these people the good news of Jesus Christ. Amen.